Means Committee for Tuesday, February 15, 2005. The committee will be at ease for a few minutes.
Oh, yeah. Traditionally, we do it the Green State Court Administrator, if I may.
It's wonderful to see you both this afternoon.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
And the record will show that the committee has opened without a quorum. And Chief and Ms. Click, again, I would just ask you to go forward, recognizing that other members of the committee will join us if they're able.
Madam Chair, that's totally satisfactory, and I'll be glad to do a reprise anytime anybody's willing to listen. So, Madam Chair, and Representative Hannah, Representative Leisnant, and Ms. Lamont, I'm Wally Carson, and I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today and tomorrow and present an overview of our budget. I'm fairly optimistic. My wife and I took each other out for a Chinese dinner on Sunday night for Valentine's, and my fortune cookie had a little thing that said, "Sell your ideas. They have exceptional merit." And I could leave that with the committee. If you want to keep that in mind.
If you'd like to leave that.
I shall.
As you make copies.
Thank you. Yesterday, I'm sure you celebrated the, and we did in our minds anyway, the 195 years, if I count correctly, of our state's existence as a state. It also was the 91st year of our Supreme Court building, which, as most of you know, is two blocks to the east of us along State Street. It's the oldest continuously used public building in Oregon, I think, and with the possible exception of a unit out at the state hospital and a cell block at the Oregon State Penitentiary. And please don't draw any parallels to that, but the one thing I wanted to say is that we're not asking for a new building for the Supreme Court. Thanks to the Department of Administrative Services, particularly Kelly Friel, for his continuing help in the budget format. We've tried to comply with their program so it will work with the Legislative Fiscal Office and also work with you and be in a format to which you are accustomed. And thanks again to the Legislative Fiscal Office, especially Mrs. Robin Lamont. She has worked long and hard for a number of years with us to help us get it right in budget and materials and presentation. And Ms. Lamont, thank you very much for your continuing good support. Let me give you a vision story. We have Kingsley and I go out, Ms. Click and I go out, or go across town periodically. We have a new employees orientation where we bring in all the new employees periodically to learn about who we are and what we're doing and why we're doing it. And my father told me a story years ago about so I was coming along and three masons were laying brick, and he came to the first person, bricklayer, and said, what are you doing? And the bricklayer looked rather dumbfounded, and he said, "I'm laying brick." And so he went to the next bricklayer and said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I'm building a wall." And went to the third bricklayer, and she said, "I'm building a cathedral." Now, the point with that story is they're all correct, but one had a vision. And you will hear throughout our presentation the next 2 days, we have a vision where we think the courts ought to be, where we think Oregon ought to be, and why they ought to be there. And together we share a greater vision, the rule of law. I won't belabor the point. I'll be glad to expand upon it. It's something we share with the legislature. It's not unique. It says law in it. Someone might think, well, it's the obligation of the courts. No, it's part of our obligation, but we share it with the executive. We share it with the people of Oregon themselves. And, in fact, we share it with our nation. And that's one of the things that makes us different from many other less fortunate countries or states, for that matter. And we have it driven home. Two of our members, Justice Mitch Gillette and Justice Paul Namunis, are on a team that visit the Sakhalin Islands, part of the Russia program. And they have on-the-ground opportunity to see what justice was like changing in the Russia system, where the Russian system, where they do not have the rule of law. They're working for it, but it is frightening, I'm told. So it's very precious to all of us that we maintain to you in your work and to us in our work. The sources, of course, are our Constitution. Your statutes are the source of the rule of law, very important. To some degree, our case law is. The executive branch has its administrative rules. And the source of law, obviously, is the federal Constitution and Congress and court decisions. And those of you that have been struggling with the Blakely case and some of the others the U.S. Supreme Court has come down with are well aware that they, too, can change our landscape in an instant. So that's the rule of law, and it's all our responsibility. And I rejoice in that. The alternative of having some despot tell us how we're going to run our life is wrong. And so we're pleased to have that. A second critical focus for us is access to justice. We hope not to be a cathedral on the hill that is nice to look at, but is of no use to the population, is no help to the population. I think we're doing quite well. I'm biased. I acknowledge that. I'm also proud, which I should not be. But you'll hear more about our initiatives with the help of some of you around here, and the good feelings of all of you, I think, to make sure that we provide access to all our citizens in the state of Oregon to the court adjudication and resolution of problems. Our task is to tell you who we are and what we do, and as I understand it, we're going to proceed in three phases. Phase one is an overview, and that's who we are and what we do. And we could put you to sleep in a twinkling, I'm sure, or I could. I'll work a deal with you. When I was in pilot training, we used to joke about climbing and diving. If you wanted to make the houses bigger, you pushed the stick down. And if you wanted to make the houses smaller, you pulled the stick back. And so it's okay with me if I get in too much detail. Just pull the stick back. That means make the houses smaller, shorten it. Or if you want to go into detail, go ahead and push the stick down, and I'll understand, and we'll try to comply. Also, my wife and I have raised three children, as you heard me espouse before, and I'm quite accustomed to being interrupted without completing a full thought. Doesn't bother me at all. And in fact, I kind of enjoy it. And so I would prefer to have this be a dialogue, and we're kind of in a compressed time frame for at least the first phase, but I encourage you to jump in and ask a question. There is no such thing as a simple question or a silly question. There may, for my part, be silly answers, but I'll try to avoid those. So please engage us in a discussion of what we're doing. Now, we've tried to comply with the request to deal with what we do in terms of programs. And that's what you have on your agenda. We've selected some programs that we think are important to us and will be of interest to you. I've spent the last two decades trying to avoid what the military calls silos. And and Representative Wisnett knows it to a T better than I. But one of the big problems we're facing in the military side on transformation is for too many years there was an Army and an Air Force and a Navy. And so ever since Senator from Arizona, you remember?
Gang, Senator McCain.
No, Goldwater. Remember when? Excuse me for being personal. I shouldn't be that, but I know you know. Ever since the merged forces, the military, particularly now more than ever, is saying, "Don't do silo work. Do broad work. Don't have a Air Force communications and the Army, and they can't communicate together." Well, we've been trying to do that, so to break it up and talk about programs is a little, it can be done, and there's nothing wrong with it, and we will conform. I also put in a pitch that's one of the problems, with respect, that you folks have, not you personally, but the system that breaks ways and means into silos. That isn't the way life is. For instance, I'll make the point, we're in public safety, and that is your focus. There's a large amount of what we do has nothing to do with public safety. It's civil law, and it's and indirectly family law has it, because if we don't resolve the problems correctly in family law or satisfactorily, that usually results in some public safety discord. So, but I wanted to make that point. I wish it were otherwise. It's not up to you necessarily to decide it, but we will try to conform and put our silos together in this way, but I would encourage you to think we're struggling to make sure that we only have to do it once in our department, and it will go out to the field and across the board, and if it has an application to domestic relations, it'll go to them, and criminal law, and so on. So I'd encourage you to keep that in mind and help us if we're not doing the right thing. I will turn to Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, and then I'll come back with a little tiny piece on the Supreme Court, and then we'll go on with the agenda. So thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
For the record, Kingsley Click, the State Court Administrator, and we're going to follow the presentation materials at the let's see, stick back level. Okay. Up high, and then...
Small house,
and what we wanted to accomplish today, looking at the way that the outlines have are provided for phase one, is to provide the department overview, kind of our structural setup, and then we have four budget program areas, and so those are the ones we're going to cover today at the high level and invite your follow-up questions. And then tomorrow we'll cover our performance measures, our strategic planning, our diversity plan, and our priorities and reductions. And they all, as Chief mentioned, will flow together, but that's how we set it up. And we do have, in addition to the presentation notebooks, because the branch put together the Chief Justice's budget, a lot of our detailed information is in the blue budget binders, but I know for this first phase we're focusing more on our more narrative information. As the Chief has noted, we're the third branch of state government. It's set up in the Oregon Constitution, Article 3, and then Article 7. And in on page 1 is just a high-level overview of the statutes that cover our department. We have over 50 substantive chapters. We have put in your appendix, the first appendix, when it says citations for constitutional and statutory mandates, priorities, and timelines on the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Tax Court, Circuit Courts, and Office of the State Court Administrator. So that goes through all the citations that tell you what we do and why we do it. That statutory framework really dictates the majority of our work, both in administration as well as in our court levels. And that is where the majority of the dialogue comes from when you talk about reductions. You get into, do you just do everything that you already are supposed to do slower and maybe not as well, or do you say we only want to fund and fund well for these priorities and we'll work out something else? And that'll probably be the little bit more of the discussion tomorrow. Just briefly, at the high level on pages 2 and 3, just I know that you covered a lot of this in the public safety overview, so I'm just going to highlight the state court jurisdiction structures, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, the Tax Court, and the Circuit Courts. It tells you how many judges and staff basically are associated with those courts. Just briefly on history, in 1981, the Legislative Assembly set up the state unified system, and that was with the appellate courts and the trial courts. At the time, there was a circuit and district court, which were later merged into a single trial court level. But you will also hear reference at different times to maybe a county court, municipal court, and justice courts. And those courts have some jurisdictional structure in the state, but they're not under the Chief Justice's judicial department and not part of this budget, though there certainly impacts back and forth with certain caseload types. The tax court judge will speak briefly about the creation of the tax magistrate system, which was another component added to the judicial department in 97. And then our last major organizational change occurred October of 2003, when the public defense Services Commission was created, and the Indigent Defense Program moved out of the Judicial Department proper but remained in the Judicial Branch, and the Chief remains associated with the Commission as he will tell you in the, I guess, day after tomorrow, Thursday.
If I could just stop you just for a moment to note for the record that we now have a quorum with the presence of Senator Devlin. Thank you, and please continue.
On page 3, once it's just the administrative structure, the Chief Justice has many hats. He's not only the head of the Judicial Department, he's presiding judge of his court, and he's also my boss. And he appoints presiding judges every 2 years to be the administrative heads in the respective judicial districts, and we'll discuss that a little further on, as well as he's responsible for the administrative infrastructure of the Judicial Department. Just like DAS works for exec, the Chief Justice through our office has delegated the responsibility to manage the personnel and the legal systems, the technology systems, the financial and accounting systems for the Judicial Department as a state entity. On page 4, and when we come back to the administration and central support summary, we'll talk more about the structure of what I call the administrative infrastructure for the court system. That briefly shows what functions are performed by the Office of the State Court Administrator in relation to the trial courts and appellate courts. The map of the judicial districts you've probably seen before on page 5, we have 27 judicial districts. They follow county lines. For the majority of courts, the county line is the judicial district line, but we have about 3 or 4 that have more than one county associated with their judicial district, and we'll discuss that. On page 6, LFO staff has a summary of what the governor and chief justice's budget interactions were, but our branch as the legislative branch and understand overall balance with the executive branch has a reduction of 9% to what is termed the essential budget level. And we've called, because the terms have changed from year to year, the Chief Justice's essential budget level is really his maintenance level budget. What do we do now, the staff we have now, what does it take to carry on for the 2005-2007 biennium? And as you noted, the governor's recommended budget is a 9% reduction to the general fund part of that budget, and that's over 90% of how we are funded in the state.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question that occurred to me is that, and actually because you are unique, being a separate branch of government, I think that it might be different. A certain amount of money is set aside in the budget to deal with collective bargaining agreements that amount is actually outside the regular budget. You know, it's not in the Department of Human Services, it's not in the Department of Public Safety, it's set aside to deal with the potential of collective bargaining agreements. Once those agreements are reached, and that amount may or may not be adequate, that's an open question, would you be one of the agencies that would have some funds transferred from that to meet your needs, or would you not?
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, and Kelly may be able to speak to this more from DAS, but in the past we have been part of what is called the Central State Employees pot of funds that's used when there is a distribution made, because it goes to both the collective bargaining and the non-collective bargaining. We never make that presumption, so we always have a policy package in the Chief Justice's budget that also addresses the compensation and the health benefit increases, but that's not part of the essential budget level, but is part of a policy package.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify so that you weren't actually, I wanted to make sure that you weren't kept out of that actually as a matter of practice. So thank you very much for your answer.
Members, I think this might be a good time to just step back for a moment, and I'm going to ask Ms. Lamont to help us in our understanding of how the Oregon Judicial Department budget gets crafted. I know you're going to get into some more of this discussion and numbers, but because this is a separate branch of government, I think it would be helpful if we could just hear on the record now how that budget building process works or worked.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The Judicial Department has agreed to follow the instructions with regard to the development of an essential budget level, which is the Chief Justice's maintenance level. They did that. They also developed policy packages based on their identified need. The governor has the responsibility for ensuring that there is a balanced budget statewide. And so the governor, for about the last three biennia, maybe four, has essentially, while taking no position on whatever actions are being taken, that is, that the governor does not direct the Judicial Department on how to implement any of the reductions, has given the Judicial Department the same average reduction that other state agencies have been required to take. So that is why the Judicial Department currently has a reduction of 9% below the essential budget level. Because the governor takes no position with regard to the budget, the governor's budget includes approximately 80 FTE or 80 positions, less than half of which actually have any funding associated with them, because the governor took no position as to whether to approve or deny policy packages. So there are a variety of policy packages that have no funding associated with them, but the governor did not eliminate the FTE. So that will be an issue that we will need to deal with, too.
I hope that's helpful as we fly down lower level later to look at the furniture in the inside the house.
As we had mentioned, starting we have basically four major program areas, we call them, for funding purposes. And up until this last biennium, the appellate tax court operations and administration were together mainly because our office supports those functions, and as far as staffing the case records office and various things. But we've broken them out pursuant to a budget note from last time, so we'll be discussing them separately. Then we also have the trial court operations, though a lot of the central support costs, which we'll discuss in administration, are held centrally. Risk management, assessments, grant, all those things are taken care of centrally. And then we have mandated payments, which is our jurors and interpreters. So to keep us on our program timing, the first major program area for funding is about our budget is about 2.6% of the general fund, or general funded part, just for context. And about 6% of that little part is the appellate and tax court operations. And the chief was going to lead off for the appellate courts with just an opportunity to...
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Wally Carson. Page 8 gives you the structure of our court system and the appeals court. The Supreme Court is the one court that is specifically mentioned in the Constitution, both the original and following the amendment to Article 7 in 1910. The members of the committee appear, or the courts appear on page 9. Let me briefly say that the charts show the structure. We are the court of last resort in Oregon, not nationally, obviously. Someone once said that the court of last resort is last, not because they are right, but we are right because we are last. And that's the way it is. We have 7 members elected to 6-year terms. The Chief Justice is elected by the members of the court for also 6-year terms, and they may or may not be coterminous. And as Kingsley has already stated, since 1983, the Chief Justice has the additional duty, other than being a justice and being the presiding officer of the Oregon Supreme Court, is also the Chief Administrative Head of the Oregon Judicial Department. And she's outlined some of the responsibilities we have. We have some stats, and I'm always mindful of the admonition that of the statistician that drowned in a river with an average depth of 2 feet, so take them with a grain of salt. We'll be glad to explain them. We've updated them because the ones that are in the book one of them is not particularly helpful or is not as accurate as we believe it needs to be. But with that, Madam Chair, unless there are questions, I will go back to my chair in the audience and bring up Chief Judge of the Oregon Court of Appeals, is David Brewer from Eugene, a former lawyer down there and a trial judge in Eugene, and has been on the Court of Appeals for a number of years. I had it written down, but I've forgotten it. And the other person who's coming up is Henry Breithaupt, who is our tax court judge in Oregon, is one of the few and one of the best since 1981 of having a tax court that deals with, if it's a tax issue in the Oregon court system, it goes to the Court of Appeals. And Henry's very talented and was appointed and then elected a couple, 3 years ago, I think, on the tax court. And I'd ask the two of them to come up and take you through the rest of your agenda on OJD program areas, item one, the overview of the Court of Appeals, which is the hardest working in terms of numbers of courts in the country. I gave a speech 10 years ago to the Judicial Administration Committee, and it was targeted at the Court of Appeals, and the title was, Why is Oregon So Appealing? And Chief Judge Brewer might have an answer, but if he doesn't, it's not his fault. With your permission, Madam Chair, I'll take the process.
Are there questions or comments for the good Chief Justice? Thank you so much for your time.
Madam Chair, our closed staff asked where possible that we would bring in 2004 stats, so we have just started updating for those, and we passed out the Supreme Court one. These are the Court of Appeals.
Very good.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. As we get these updates, because our book tends to get pretty thick, will you help us get them in the right place so that as we go back to reference them, we all have it in the same organizational structure?
Senator Gordley, Representative Hanna, yes. And we did put on the bottom where they should go, but LFO staff suggested we could put them in right after the presentation today. We could even put them in if you weren't going to.
Good afternoon. Let me just take care of a little housekeeping matter before we continue. I've had the privilege of listening to a couple of days of Department of Corrections testimony before this committee, and some of the comments didn't get picked up on the microphone, so I want to say to Kingsley Click, when you're speaking, please make sure that microphone is very close to you. Senator Winters, please make sure that all of your comments.
Can I talk softly?
Onto the.
I have already moved mine, Madam Chair.
I find my big stick though.
Thank you very much, and please continue. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having us, Chair Gordley, members of the committee, and Ms. Lamott. My name is Dave Brewer. I'm the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals, and it's my privilege to be here today to talk to you about our court's operation and place in the judicial branch. As I was listening to the Chief Justice's remarks, I feel like I should start off by making a comment about that Russian expedition that judges from this state took 2 years ago. I had the privilege of being one of the 5 members of that delegation and conducting the first jury trial ever held in the Russian Far East in Sakhalin. And when we talk about rule of law and the gratitude that I and my colleagues have for being in this country and in this state, I just want to share with you three tiny vignettes that will take about 30 seconds to think about. The first is when we got to a courtroom there, we found that all of the defendants were being tried in cages, not sitting at counsel table, but in cages and bound. The second thing I'll share with you is that the idea of having members of the public buy into the system and participate in jury service was utterly unheard of. You couldn't get people to come and do jury service because they didn't trust the system. Nobody showed up. Their turnout rate was less than 3% for those summoned. And the third is that people didn't trust the judges. The judges were thought to be corrupt because what they did to supplement their income, they weren't paid adequate wages or salary at all, was either to go out and take other jobs or take bribes. That was the reputation that the system had. But what I saw in the eyes of the Russian lawyers and judges as they were embarking on an experiment in the rule of law was a look of hope that I think we all share about obtaining and maintaining a fair justice system where everyone has access to the courts and can expect to be treated freely, fairly. That was the most profound experience I've ever had in the justice system, and it's in my mind as I have the privilege of addressing you today. As the Chief said, our court is the intermediate appellate court in the state of Oregon. It's a 10-judge intermediate appellate court that's elected statewide, and Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I can indicate to you that the handout you received is part of the Phase 1 materials at pages 16 and 17 of your materials, which gives you some stats for us. With the exception of a limited number of appeals that go directly to the Supreme Court, we receive, generally speaking, every appeal from decisions that are made by state trial courts and administrative agencies in Oregon. And the citizens of Oregon have an unqualified right to appeal adverse decisions to our court. If a litigant is dissatisfied with a decision that we make, he or she can seek review before the Supreme Court, which has discretion whether or not to review our decisions. And as the Chief, I believe, will tell you, the Supreme Court reviews between 6 and 9% of our decisions each year. There are 36 intermediate appellate courts in this country, and generally speaking, the Court of Appeals of Oregon ranks first or second in terms of overall workload nationally. Over the last 10 years, we've averaged between 3,500 and 4,000 appeals per year. So whether you measure it from number of cases filed per citizen or number of appeals per judge, we rank near the top every single year. I don't think any of us have an answer to the $64,000 question of why we're so appealing, except possibly for this. I think that part of it has to do with the tremendous breadth of jurisdiction that Oregon's Court of Appeals and Oregon's courts in general have. We not only have all of the trial court appeals, but all the agency appeals as well. And so that accounts for a huge volume. Over the years, you might be interested to know that our case mix and volume have been fairly steady. You can see that from the stat sheets we've given you, with probably three or four broad brush exceptions. And I just thought I'd take a minute to give you a sense of how our work ebbs and flows. First, we often, as you can guess, have an increase in appeals after the end of a legislative session, where you've enacted a batch of new statutes and the meaning of those statutes is questioned. Last session, for example, you may remember HB 2646, which was the judgments bill. That completely overhauled the form and content of judgments in Oregon's trial courts. We had about 12 appeals immediately on the heels of the enactment of those statutes, questioning the meaning of various of the statutes. And we had to set aside resources, and we were glad to do that and did, to decide those appeals so that trial court judges and litigants could have an understanding of how those statutes work from the court's perspective. So it's the workload at the end of the session that can cause some spikes. Secondly, and this is critical, I think, to this session, our workload can be affected dramatically. You'll hear this in the trial court piece, too, by decisions made by the federal courts. As you know, the United States Supreme Court is the ultimate decision maker as to what the federal Constitution is. This subcommittee deals with criminal law case loads tremendously in the justice system. And by the way, as you can see in looking at our stats, between 50 and 55% of our cases every year are direct criminal appeals or prisoner litigation relating to criminal convictions. So we are a court that deals heavily with public safety issues and with criminal justice issues. This last year, the Supreme Court decided U.S. versus Blakely, and most recently, U.S. versus Booker. Those two cases, along with their predecessor, Apprendi, construed the federal Constitution to indicate that there is a right to a jury trial at various phases of sentencing, something that was previously unknown throughout the states. It's caused a tremendous amount of litigation in the state courts around the country in determining how far this right to jury trial extends. As the U.S. Supreme Court often does, in the Blakely cases, for example, they just gave us the broad brush detail. The specific details were left to the state courts to resolve. That's what we're doing. Right now, our court and the Supreme Court have identified about 15 Lee Blakely cases that will decide specific issues that are left open by the Blakely decision. And we are currently looking at about 200 to 250 appeals in our court that either deal exclusively with or primarily with Blakely issues. That's something we can't predict in advance. That's not something we can meter our workflow to, but it does significantly affect our workload. A third exception to case stability, if you'll take a look at the materials there under our numbers, you'll see that our number of appeals in 2002 and 2003 went down somewhat and then back up again in 2004. The reason for that in significant measure was the temporary reduction in appeals from criminal cases that resulted toward the end of the last biennium when fewer criminal cases were being processed in the trial courts. That created a lag where there would be fewer appeals for a period of time, and as you can see, starting in 2004, that spiked back up again, and we're expecting significant additional increases this year. And so funding issues also can affect the stability of the court's numbers. Our court sits in regular panels of three judges. We hear between 12 and 30 cases per panel sitting, which is at least three times a month. We also schedule a fourth panel to hear cases we call fast-track cases, to which we give priority by statute. In other words, by your direction. Chief among those kinds of cases to which we must give statutory priority are criminal cases where the defendant is in custody. You've prescribed that by statute. Juvenile dependency, termination of parental rights, land use and workers' compensation appeals. So, for example, where a felony defendant is in custody, we have to decide that case within 180 days following submission, and we generally do that within 90 days. The same is true, for example, in land use cases. We're required to process those cases within 91 days of decision, and we generally process those in about 60 days in order to keep those cases moving through the system as well. Since the 80s, our court has substantially reduced its backlog of cases. Today, once a case is submitted for decision, a written decision is generally published within about 90 days. And in addition, it usually takes no more than 90 days to schedule a case for argument after the lawyers have finished their briefs in the case. And I checked again today. I can tell you that we only have four cases in our court that have been under submission for as long as 12 months. Virtually all of those are pending before the full court. In other words, they're such complicated issues that all 10 judges of our court are considering those cases. That is a minute fraction of our caseload. We're very mindful of the need to make timely decisions, and we do our level best to do that so that our docket can move forward. I just wanted to mention briefly two programs that I think might be of special interest to you that maybe will share a little bit about the character of our court and our attitude. The first is our appellate settlement program. I would be the first to tell you that litigation in general is too costly and takes too long, and we want to do our best to shorten those timelines. To do that, our court has adopted an appellate settlement program. Each year, our court is able to settle through that program approximately 150 to 200 civil, domestic relations, and workers' comp appeals. Cases are screened for the program, and our settlement rate in 2004, 70% of those that voluntarily participate, is among the highest in the nation. The feedback from this program was positive, and we believe that an effective settlement program promotes public trust and confidence in the courts. It also helps us decide our remaining cases more expeditiously. We use trained lawyers to do this, as well as retired trial judges for the most part. They bring enormous expertise and experience to the task. It's a voluntary program, and yet it helps us clear our docket appropriately, and we believe that that's critical. The other thing is that you know, particularly because of issues relating to funding and education, is an awful lot of our high school and middle school students today receive virtually no instruction in government or civics, something that probably most of us took for granted when we were in high school. We recognize our role as a statewide court, and we believe in making our work accessible and understandable to the public. So for that reason, we regularly sit in schools throughout the state, as does the Supreme Court. We hold oral argument in real cases. We talk to students, members of the community about the importance of the rule of law, what we started out with here, and how our government works. For example, during the next nine months, we'll hold court sessions in McMinnville, actually tomorrow in McMinnville, Roseburg next month, Canby in the following month in May, Bend, Hood River, and Pendleton. And one of the things I want to offer to each of you today is the chance to have us sit in a high school or middle school in your district. We'd love to do it. We'd love to have you join us. We believe that our role with you and the justice system is one of partnership. We want to respect that role, and as the Chief said, we want to have an ongoing conversation with you that helps us promote good government. So I know I've talked fast, I've covered a lot of ground, but with that, I'm finished. I'd be glad to answer any questions you have about the Court of Appeals.
Thank you, and thank you very much for the presentation. Could you speak to us about the performance measure, which is listed as appeals pending? Can you unpack that for us and tell us what is the target for 2005 and beyond?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This particular performance measure is one that I suppose is as good as we have found so far, but is a difficult one to adequately capture and use as a predictor. First of all, it looks at the total number of appeals pending in relation to the total number of filings per year. And you can see readily that the biggest variable and the one that we have the least control over is the number of filings. So that ratio can change in many ways due to circumstances beyond our control. If we do the same amount of work from year to year and we have fewer filings, we look more efficient under that measure. If we have more filings, we look less efficient. So there's an inherent flaw in that regard. But the way I view it, the lowest we've ever been of pending to filings is 1.09. We'd like to stay at or near that level or the 1.10 level. We're at 1.14 right now. But again, that's a measure that we have partial control over, not complete control over. You'll notice that what I added, Madam Chair, is published opinions. And I put that in for last year and this year because I think that, in many ways, is a more telling performance measure. And after I became chief last November, I felt that statistic might be more useful to you. And as you can see from one of the footnotes in the handout, our published opinions increased from 349 in 2003 to 361 in 2004, despite the fact that we were short a judge due to a retirement starting November 1st of last year. So the meaty cases continue, and that number of pendings to filings doesn't really tell anywhere close to the whole story. Many of the filings that we have every year are cases that are not complicated. So I mentioned Blakely. Once we get those lead cases decided, we'll have a number of cases following along that won't require a lot of separate time and attention. On the other hand, we may have four or five cases in a particular year that present issues of first impression, and getting an opinion out in that case takes a lot more of the court's resources. So you don't see a weighting here in terms of the substantiality of a case. And what I would like to do is in the future look at that as a perhaps even more useful performance measure for you. But in the meantime, this ratio of appeals pending to filings and the number of published written opinions, I think, may be helpful to you. I hope that answers your question.
Partially, where are you referencing, what document are you referencing when you speak to us about published opinions?
If you take a look at, Madam Chair, if you take a look at the second page or the reverse side of the budget narrative, you'll see at the bottom of the chart published opinions. And I gathered the data and added that for at least the last 2 years so that you could see that number.
Again, with the intent to include that as a performance measure.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Judge Brewer, a couple of things. Let me give them to you, because then you fight back pretty fast, too. Okay. In the juvenile, you've got a footnote that says we transferred in 203 dependency and delinquent cases, but the numbers are stayed about the same. So does that mean that they've really increased there? The second thing is, I would appreciate you talking about the special court again. I missed some of that, and I thought that was very effective in how you do that and what it was. I didn't get the title and all that, and you don't have the documentation of those cases in the chart.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Wisnett. Your first question is, we did have an upward spike in those juvenile filings this last year. We had more juvenile dependency cases filed, a significantly larger number last year than we had in previous years, and I'll be very interested as a little more time passes in trying to learn exactly why. I'm not sure as we speak today, but that number did spike significantly. With regard to your second question, I think you were referring to the appellate mediation program. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And the statistics for that program are not separately included here, except in one respect. They are included, if you look at the second side of the sheet there, in the total cases closed. That figure for total closed cases includes the cases resolved in that program. And that program is a voluntary program that we do staff with, I believe, the equivalent of two FTEs, including a half-time executive director, Judy Henry, who's an attorney and a special mediator. And we also use volunteer mediators who are, generally speaking, retired trial court judges and competent lawyers who are qualified mediators to help us staff those cases. We identify primarily civil cases, domestic relations, and workers' comp cases rather than criminal cases for those programs, for reasons that you can probably imagine, is that the court is more reluctant to get involved in the settlement of criminal cases. We've done a few of those, but it's primarily civil. And we screen cases through the program that we think would be useful for mediation. We contact the parties to see if they would like to participate. If they tell us that there's no real value to be gained from it, we accept that. We don't force people to participate in that program because we have plenty of work to do, and we find that it works better if it's a voluntary program.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Question? We just had our side
book. Okay.
Please continue.
All right. Well, I was finished with my prepared remarks, Madam Chair, unless there are other questions that the committee has.
Thank you very much for the time being, and we may come back to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your time.
Please identify yourself for the record, please, and go forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Henry Breithaupt, the judge of the Oregon Tax Court. And like Chief Judge Brewer, Chief Justice, and Kingsley Click, I'm happy to be here today to talk about, in my case, one relatively small corner of the world, that is the Oregon Tax Court. Created in 1961, it has had since 1961, at any given time, one judge. And I'm happy and proud to be serving in that position today. The court decides state tax law cases arising under the tax laws of this state. That's its jurisdiction. It has a limited jurisdiction, but within its jurisdiction, it's exclusive. It is the court that is to decide those. The court also, since 1997, has had a magistrate division staffed currently by five magistrates who essentially handle a first level of hearing or appeal. And I would say, just to key off of what both the Chief Justice and Chief Judge Brewer have said, we all at the tax court believe that the subject of taxation and the relationship between the citizen and the state regarding taxation is a very special one and sometimes a very difficult one. We treat it as a very serious issue. It may not be a public safety issue, but it is a public confidence issue. And I just cite, again, not to pick on another country, but the Russian Republic. As many of us know, recently has had the experience where a major company, Yukos, the oil company, its chief executive got crosswise with the president of the Russian Republic, Mr. Putin, following which Yukos was served with a notice that it owed $6 billion in taxes that it hadn't paid, following which Mr. Khodorkovsky went to jail, Yukos went into receivership, and is now owned by another group. Now, none of that process or outcome has produced anything but concern in the international financial community and undoubtedly within the former Soviet Union and within the Russian Republic in particular, a great deal of concern about whether or not taxation is going to be a method of public finance or a method of retribution. Now, Oregon, happily, since 1961, has had a court specifically set aside to decide questions involving taxation. It does not have criminal jurisdiction. The court does not have a jury, but it decides what amount of tax is owed or the status of property or taxpayers. As I said, we operate in two divisions, and one thing, and perhaps one reason that we're here today or that I'm here today, both we're located in Salem, and secondly, we're sort of like it's a candy mint, it's a breath mint, it's both. We're a trial court, and yet all of our decisions, whether made by a magistrate or by myself, must be in writing and must be reasoned decisions. Not just you win, but here's why you win. In that respect, we look and act a little bit like the Court of Appeals and not our colleagues in the trial courts. The legislature in 1997 created the magistrate division and moved the first hearing on tax disputes from the Department of Revenue over to the judicial branch. It set up in the magistrate division a place where people are expected to go first, with very limited exceptions, a less formal process, an easy-to-use process that was designed, I believe the legislature's intent was, to resolve cases if at all possible. And the good news is, in over 90% of the cases that go to the magistrate division, that's the last place they go. They are resolved. And that is in a context where if either party, whether it's the government who wishes to have taxation or the citizen who wishes to avoid it, if either party is dissatisfied with what a magistrate decides, that party can, for $50, file an appeal with the regular division and have the case heard by me anew. You know, clean the blackboard off and start over. The magistrate division does not create a record. It follows very informal procedures, a broad degree of representation. People are not required to appear by an attorney. They may appear with an accountant or a real estate broker. We have at least one bill pending. We have several bills pending in the legislature this session, one of which is to actually expand that representation slightly so that in the case, for example, of an older Oregonian, they might have a family member that could appear with them and help them. But the good news is, as I said, is that the magistrate division resolves the vast majority of those cases. When they are not resolved, they come to my division. A record is created. We follow the Oregon Evidence Code. Looks much more like a proceeding before a judge in a regular circuit court. And if the decision that I render, again in writing and with reasons, is not satisfactory, then the taxpayer has a right to go to the Oregon Supreme Court. It's not a review matter. They have a right to go there and to have the Supreme Court review my work.
Would you hold your thought there and
yes?
Take a question or comment from Representative Hanna?
Yes.
Question or two. Help us understand, those that aren't legal beagles, one, to enter this court, it has to be through an appeals process, or there's been a prior hearing before you could ever get to your level at the court?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, if imagine now, if you will, the Oregon Tax Court, as it literally does, it has two floors in the Robertson Building, the third floor and the fourth floor. If the citizen has a problem with taxation, they first go to the third floor of the building, and there they have a process with the magistrate.
Okay.
At the end of which, if they're dissatisfied with that process, they take $50, go up one floor, hand the $50 to me, so to speak, one of my staff people, and they get in a sense, an appeal, but we start fresh.
Okay. And follow up, if I may, Madam Chair. The other thing, you said you don't have criminal jurisdiction. What if this was a county versus whoever in terms of a tax dispute, and it was fraudulent or something that would turn criminal? How does that work? Where would you reassign the case?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, a very good question, and one I pondered at the time that I was appointed to the court. No criminal jurisdiction, primarily because there is no jury in the tax court. And so the right to jury trial, it doesn't fit. The research that I have done indicates the following. If there is a tax crime, and there are relatively few in Oregon, unlike the federal system, if there is a tax crime, that would be prosecuted in the regular circuit court by the district attorney, or in some cases perhaps by the attorney general. It is not a matter of where I would refer it. It is simply that in my court, that behavior would be dealt with typically, and let's assume that I made a finding that, in fact, there had been bad behavior.
Mm-hmm.
The result in my court would be taxpayer owes more tax money. They owe interest. They may owe a substantial financial penalty. And then we would stop. That is to say, I would stop. At that point, whether a district attorney or the attorney general would pick it up, I would not know.
May I follow up once more, please? I want to understand how this works. So, do you report that to, if it's somebody from Douglas County or Lane County? I mean, does it go back in terms of reporting to whatever jurisdiction to the district attorney's office? Or is it just I walk out of there and take a deep breath and hope when I go home my district attorney isn't looking? I mean, how does that work?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I am speculating here because I have never actually had it occur. I have been on the court since 2001. But I would say this, while I am speculating, I think this is good speculation, and that is my role is to deal with the case in front of me on the civil side. There is always in that court proceeding a representative of a government, either the Attorney General's office representing the Department of Revenue, or a county council, for example, representing a county, or in some cases both. And I would expect that either those lawyers or their clients, the revenue agencies, if they felt there was this level of bad behavior, would promptly contact the relevant law enforcement official. But as I say, I've never had anyone tell me what happened in any case that even got, and I must say I haven't seen anywhere it seemed to be fraudulent on its face. Thank you.
That's your
Representative Wisnot.
Thank you. While we have a break, I'll interrupt you, Judge.
Yes.
The few Measure 37 cases the state will receive, will they go to you?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnot, they will not. The Measure 37, as adopted by the people of the state of Oregon, places jurisdiction in the circuit court where the property is located.
Please continue.
Thank you very much. I believe Kingsley Click explained to you that since 1983, the court system in Oregon has been unified on a statewide basis in terms of the administration of justice generally. Happily, in the case of the tax court, there is only one judge and five magistrates, and we go statewide. We do not have to coordinate Umatilla County with Curry County. We sit generally in Salem, but travel when we can and when we believe it's appropriate to where the taxpayer and their witnesses and representatives are located. As a practical matter, many of the cases arise in the Willamette Valley. People are happy to come to Salem, but where we can, where budget permits and where time permits, we go to where the taxpayers are located. The relationship with the taxpayers, as I say, because it is a matter of public confidence and because it is a particularly sensitive issue, almost always, we try to make information about how to work through the process readily available. We have a handbook which county officials, Department of Revenue officials, and others have available to hand out. We have a website which we try to manage very carefully and make useful, to which regular reference is made. We hope in that process and have some evidence that in that process people have a chance to learn what their obligations are. Again, I should say, each of the decisions, whether it's a magistrate or myself, each decision is a written decision, and it's published, and it's on the website. And I know that the magistrates do, and I know that I do. In the early stages of a dispute, if we believe there is a case that would be of guidance to the parties, we will mention it. And if somebody has a computer terminal or can go to the library and get one, they can do a little legal research and see what happened to some other people before them, for good or for ill. And we believe that has had some positive effect. I will say that we have experienced, I believe, perhaps because of the impact and full implementation of Measure 50, a diminution, actually, in the caseload of the court. Speaking now especially at the magistrate division level, and we have taken some efforts to reduce our staffing in light of that. Cases so far, having that, those staff resources go to the judicial department generally, where they've been received happily, and we're glad to do that in a way of being good stewards of the resources that with which we have been entrusted, and where we have a little more than we need, we're glad to share them back with the system generally, the trial courts especially, that have need for those. With that, my comments are concluded, but be glad to take any other questions.
Is there a particular performance measure or performance measures that you would draw our attention to that reflect your work?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do not have a performance measure in the material that you have been provided. I was talking beforehand with Chief Judge Brewer. I believe in our case the performance measure that would perhaps be most instructive would be time, the time it takes for a decision to be rendered. And we have internally a standard at the magistrate division that matters be decided within 6 months, and we've been able to hold to that. That is from the time that they are instituted. At the regular division, I do not have such a measure, and in part that's because there's one of me, and if as has occurred, there are 10 cases pending, I work on them as I can, but the particular circumstance of one judge makes that a little more difficult. I believe, and we could supply that, talk with the committee staff happily about what would be appropriate. I'd be glad to do that.
And particularly as it relates back to the 1997 legislation and legislative intent.
Yes, you're saying to have that performance measure.
Yes.
Yes, I think we both can do that, and I won't say anecdotally, but without having done a statistical analysis, I believe that the magistrate division has met and may perhaps exceeded, but certainly met the legislature's goals in terms of getting cases processed in a timely fashion and getting them either resolved or moved on to the regular division. Thank you.
We'll take a look at that with you again. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your Honor, since you are an appellate judge, I'm just trying to clear up something in my own mind. The decisions made by the magistrate, they appeal to you, you render a decision. Is that decision broadly binding on the Department of Revenue and county assessment and taxation departments in terms of not just the case specific, but if you interpret something differently from how the department has interpreted it, are they obligated by law to follow your interpretation?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, thank you. My answer would be yes, with an explanation if I may. I am both a trial court. I have one aspect of my work which is a trial court work, and then one aspect which looks like appellate court work. That is, there is a reasoned decision that explains how I view the law of Oregon. Now, assume for a moment that that decision is not appealed to the Supreme Court, or if appealed, is affirmed. in either of those cases, which I think is the premise of your question, that will be binding on the department, the counties, until it is altered by legislation or by a later case, should one come along and the Supreme Court change the rule. But yes, the goal, I believe, in setting up the tax court in 1961 was to have just such a court, subject to Supreme Court review, to have a court which would explain what the law of Oregon is, and that would then be guidance in all of the counties, for all of the counties and for the Department of Revenue.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you for your presentation and for your presence. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Quick, what are we doing next?
And I just wish to call the chair's attention to the fact that the fortune is still here.
Very good. For the record, Kings looks like State Court Administrator. Madam Chair, we're going to bring up the trial court program area next with the Honorable Judge Koch, the presiding judge of Multnomah County Circuit Court, 4th Judicial District. Oh, isn't it? And Doug Gray, who's our trial court administrator. This is the largest court and judicial district in the state, as they will let you know a bit about the caseload and the structure there. But there are representatives for the entire trial court summary. And rather than me leading in with a broad overview of the map that shows you there's 27 judicial districts, I'm going to let them cover generally the courts of the state, and then I can fill in with any overview materials that we didn't cover during this time. And before we get to that, Chair Gordley, I just want to mention on the performance measures. Our budget note from last biennium focused on setting trial court standards and administration standards and performance measures, and that took the majority of our energy, and we put in our administrative ones, performance measures that do relate to the appellate courts, but we also know that, you know, we have a little bit more work to do to look at what might be more significant. We have a lot of output measures that work with the appellate courts, but outcomes is a really different kind of ball game. So that's something we hope over this next biennium we'll have a little more chance to look at.
I appreciate that information and that acknowledgement of the concern. Good afternoon, Judge Koch.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Great to see you.
Great to see you again, too. And thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for inviting us to participate this afternoon. I'm Dale Koch. I'm the presiding judge in Multnomah County. I'm one of 169 circuit court judges in the state of Oregon. All of us are elected for six-year terms. I'm now entering my 13th year on the bench, my third year, although it seems like 13th year, as presiding judge in Multnomah County.
May I interrupt you just for a moment?
Could you please direct us to the appropriate page in the...
The material covering the trial courts really starts on about page 35 and runs through approximately page 44.
I apologize for the interruption.
No. My apologies.
And I do also have 2004 updated information, and it should say 35.
Okay. As the Chief Justice indicated during his presentation, each of the presiding judges for each of the 27 judicial districts, which make up the 36 counties in the state, each of the presiding judges is appointed by the Chief Justice. We serve two-year terms. I'm in the, obviously in the middle of my second term as presiding judge in Multnomah County. Just to give you a little idea of the work that we do in the circuit court, in Oregon we have one level of trial court, just the circuit court. The circuit and district courts were consolidated, and that process was completed in January of 1998. That allows us to have many efficiencies in terms of the operation of the court. It also means that our judges handle a wide variety of cases. We handle all of the criminal cases, civil cases, domestic relations matters, juvenile matters, both juvenile delinquency and child abuse cases, small claims, domestic violence cases, probate, mental commitments, adoptions, guardianship, traffic cases, and in Multnomah County, we also handle all of the parking tags that are filed. Last year, for instance, we had 280,000 parking tags that came through, violations that came through our court. If you look at the numbers, you'll see that the numbers do vary from year to year in terms of the number of cases, but we have had over 600,000 cases, separate and apart from the parking cases, that have been filed in the circuit court in each of the last 7 years. Some of the variations that you'll see will reflect budget reductions that occurred in the middle of the last biennium, or actually at the end of the last biennium. A part of that resulting in the courts actually being closed to the public on Fridays for March through the 1st of July of that year. The question came as to where Measure 37 cases are filed. We are it. We turn out to be where those cases will, in fact, be filed. Also, I just had a visit from county council in our county a couple of weeks ago to advise me that we were also going to be the lucky recipients of approximately 5,000 ITAX lawsuits that were going to be filed in Multnomah County income tax in terms of people that haven't yet paid that tax. Those 3,000 to 5,000 cases will end up being filed in our circuit court. It's things like that that cause the variations in the numbers that you see. We never know what's going to show up. We do not control the filings that occur. They're controlled by a number of different factors. For instance, the violation numbers were down significantly last year. That really is almost entirely the result of the Portland Police Bureau turning the faucet down a little bit from where it had been the year before when they'd filed 150,000 traffic citations in our county. They filed 117 last year. So you take a look at that number, it just about corresponds to the reduction of tickets. We don't know yet how those numbers are going to look for this year. In each of the judicial districts, there's also a trial court administrator. Doug Bray is the trial court administrator in Multnomah County. I never go anywhere without him because he actually knows how the court operates. I'm the administrative head, but he's really the one that operates and is responsible for the operations of the court. Through the years, the courts, the circuit courts in the state of Oregon and in Multnomah County have attempted to implement, as resources permitted, a number of different innovative programs. I'm just going to briefly touch on some of those. I know Nancy Miller is going to talk about those, some more of those later when she's speaking to you. In many of the counties have an integrated family court at this point, using the model of one judge, one family, where the judge who's handling the case not only would be dealing with the domestic relations part of the case, but potentially also dealing with any domestic violence elements in the case, dealing with the juvenile dependency if there's a child abuse and neglect case filed. And in some jurisdictions, such as ours, that judge will also, if a parent is on probation, be the probation judge, so that we have a consistent approach in terms of dealing with the issues that are involving that family. Multnomah County has formed the third drug court in the country. Now there are hundreds of drug courts, if not thousands of drug courts throughout the country because of the success of that model. We have a number of other drug courts throughout the state of Oregon.
Madam Chair.
Senator Winters.
Is Multnomah County looking at a mental health court as well as drug court?
We are looking at a mental health court. I know Clackamas County has a very successful mental health court at this time, and in fact we were fairly close to implementing some mental health court model before the budget cuts that occurred in the end of the 2003, the biennium ended in June of 2003. At that point, we cut back on those efforts, partly because to have a successful mental health court, you also have to have mental health treatment resources, and that was one of the issues that we were finding most troubling. The other part of a mental health court, in terms of what we were looking at in our county, is it is a very large population that is involved in the criminal justice system that has mental health issues. So if We want to make sure that the resources that we are providing to the people that need those resources get to everybody and not just a limited few who might be in a boutique-type court. One of the things I'd like to talk about, I know you're going to hear more about it, and Judge Block was here a few minutes earlier, is the drunk driving supervision program, intensive supervision program that has been in place in Multnomah County since 1998. That program has showed amazing success. The numbers there are that they are having a reoffense rate for people that have successfully participated in that program, and a lot of these are hardcore alcoholics, people that are on either their second or third DWI arrest, that the reoffense rate is only 3.7% for those that have participated and successfully completed that program, as opposed to the average reoffense rate in the state of Oregon of over 20%.
And how long has that program?
It's been in place since 1998. It's been primarily federally grant-funded up until this point. One of the other parts of that, which was interesting when they looked at the success or in terms of people who successfully completed that program, was a reduction of in terms of people that had subsequent arrests for domestic violence cases, a reduction of almost fourfold in terms of the percentage of those people that successfully completed the program who were rearrested for domestic violence incidents as opposed to those people who did not successfully complete the program. You know, components of that program that are really successful include requirements that the people be fully employed, and it's a public private partnership in terms of who's providing the services to the people that are involved in the program. I can talk a lot more about that, but I know Judge Block will probably be bending people's ears over the next couple of months on that issue. I'd also like to talk about we have community court services, which is an early disposition court. That's one of the programs that we still have, the community courts in Multnomah County. Unfortunately, at this point, they're no longer located in the community, but rather they're all located in the Justice Center downtown, and that's one of the changes that we made in 2003 when we were trying to look at ways to cut our spending. Arbitration and mediation programs exist all over the state at this point in time across a wide spectrum of cases, because we find if people can actually participate themselves in solving their problem instead of having the court solve it for them. In other words, if they can participate in the decision themselves, they're going to be more likely to buy into that decision, and that decision is more likely to actually solve the problem. And we have arbitration and mediation programs for small claims, for landlord-tenant actions, for juvenile dependency cases, child abuse and neglect cases, civil cases. We have them across a wide spectrum of cases. One trial, one day of jury service is a program that's been implemented through the years here in the state of Oregon. Justice Brewer talked about the low level of participation in juries in Russia, and we are always working here to find ways to increase the level of participation by citizens in the jury process. If the citizens don't participate in the jury process, then they'll have no faith in the justice system. So we need to constantly be looking for ways to improve that participation. One of the ways to do that was through just calling them in for one day, as opposed to when I started as a lawyer, when jurors get called in for a month. So we've been able to work towards that. Again, one of the things that occurred in Multnomah County as we were going through the budget cycle is we backed away from that one-day model. Instead of bringing in jurors 5 days a week, one day at a time, we started bringing them in 4 days a week, 2 days at a time. Again, just ways to try to find some ways to save some money. We find that we have less people who can participate even if we go from 1 day to 2 days, so we've moved back to the one-day system at least for now. I'll let Nancy talk about the Juvenile Court Improvement Project. Parent education programs were legislatively mandated and very successful in helping educate parents about the impact of a dissolution or separation or custody dispute on their children. The customer satisfaction surveys that we get back from the people that participate in that program are amazing. Well over 75% of the people that participate say, hey, I'm glad I was required to go do this. So that's a program that really does make a difference. Domestic Relations Pro Se Service Centers. That's one of those things that you take a look at and say, well, geez, why are we providing a court service to people that are going through a domestic relations dispute? Well, what's happened over the years is that the domestic relations laws become increasingly complex at a time where we have a higher and higher percentage of people who can't afford a lawyer to help them go through that process. And the latest numbers we're seeing are more than 65% of the domestic relations cases, in more than 65% of the cases, one or more of the parties is attempting to represent themselves. So one of the programs that we started in Multnomah County, we weren't the first. We saw the model in Marion County, and it was a very successful model down there, is to provide a pro se facilitation center where somebody could come in and be assisted in filling out their paperwork. They can't get legal advice. The person's not going to represent them, but can just assist them in going through the process of filling out the papers. And part of that process has gone on through the state court administrator's office is to develop a set of forms that's on the website so that people can access those forms. If they want to do the work themselves and not go through the facilitation center. In Multnomah County, we now answer over 1,000 calls a month from people who are representing themselves trying to deal with their domestic relations issues. One of the things I'd just like to point out about at the trial court level, just to follow up on the work that we're trying to do, it was referenced by the chief, the fact that none of us are in a silo at the trial court level. We all work together. We saw particularly during the end of 2003, that the whole system is a big balloon, and every time we squeezed on one end of the system, it would have an impact on another end of the system, whether it be indigent defense, jails, police, district attorneys and prosecutors, mental health services, drug and alcohol services. All of those impact the cases we get and our ability to effectively deal with those cases. So in every county, there's a local public safety coordinating council. We have that council in our county. We meet on a kind of a policy level basis once a month and a work level basis once a month, where I sit down with trial court administrators there, the sheriff's there, the district attorney is there, the public defender is there, representative from the Department of Community Justice who provide parole and probation services are there, and we just sit down and talk through, okay, what's happening in the system now? Where's there a shove in our system? How can we deal with that shove? And that's part of how we got through the budget issues 2 years ago. The district attorney in our county just started charging what used to be felonies as misdemeanors and what used to be misdemeanors as violations, and we moved the cases through the system. Had we not done that, we would still be looking at a huge backlog of cases that we hadn't been able to resolve. In other counties, they dealt with it with plioramas. I mean, they really sat down at the start of this biennium, took these big caseloads, and just dealt with the cases. And that is not a good way to run a criminal justice system or a justice system in general, but that's what we are faced with doing. We're going to try to solve the problems, not make them worse. So that's how we dealt with that as we went through that. One of the other things that we no longer have in the system are court reporters. There are very, very few court reporters anymore in the state. We have one court reporter in Multnomah County because we have a judge who's significantly hearing impaired, and we have a real-time reporter in her courtroom. That works fine at the trial court level. That was part of, again, how we got through the cuts that occurred in the last biennium, but they're not there anymore to cut again. We've eliminated those positions, and if we hadn't eliminated those positions, we would eliminate a lot of other staff positions, the people that just process the paperwork, make the data entry, and staff the courtrooms. At this point, I think I'll just turn it over to Doug Bray, the trial court administrator.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge, please educate me. Where did we come up with the 27 circuit districts and the 169 circuit judges? I live in Deschutes County, and I know we just gained a judge a couple of years ago. Is that based upon population? And along with that, you make a statement in the written testimony here that there are numerous legislatively mandated local committees that presiding judges and trial court administrators must either initiate or attend. Are there some of those that we need to look at eliminating to help you have more time?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, the circuit court positions are created by the legislature. I would like to say that all of those positions have been created solely upon workload. They haven't necessarily all been created that way. The legislature will be presented again this session, as they are each session, the results of a study that has been done, weighing the cases, case types which have different requirements for judicial time. For instance, civil cases take more time than small claims court cases or violations. In terms of looking at how short each of the counties are around the state in terms of judicial resources. The other thing that happens in terms of the number of judges that are in each of the counties, sometimes we're in a situation like we are in Clackamas County, which historically they show that they are underjudged. In other words, they've got a much greater caseload than they have judges, but they don't have any courtrooms to put them in. You have other counties like Deschutes County, Washington County. They're very rapidly growing counties, and they have trouble keeping up with the number of judges that they need to staff those counties. So, but there is a study that has been presented to the legislature. I think each session, Kingsley could correct me in terms of how many sessions that's been, but several sessions now, that tries to take an objective look at the number of judges that are necessary to do the work in those respective counties. In terms of your second question about mandated committees, I think we find that most of those really are effective uses of our time, because most of them do involve kind of sitting down collaboratively, taking a look at where the pressures are in our system and trying to address problems in advance rather than after they become a bigger problem for us.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I guess I'd follow up then. So we're going to look at numbers of the circuit courts and the judges, that's this committee?
We will be going down to that lower level look that the Chief was speaking about earlier.
Thank you.
Senator Winters, and then we will go to Mr. Bray.
Just on that same subject, that when we get down into the detail level, that we would look at not only the current study or the current recommendation, but what previous studies and recommendations have been made with respect to the needs of judges around the state, because that will give some historic perspective to other members who weren't here in the debate on how we got the judges. Might be very helpful.
In fact, I would ask that report be pulled off shelves and recirculated to members of this committee. I know the topic is going to come up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, excuse me for interrupting. I mm-hmm. believe that any bill establishing new judgeships would first go through a substantive committee and then would be referred to Ways and Means. So we would receive it after it had been reviewed and if it is approved by a substantive committee.
I appreciate that. I think Senator Winters is referring to a past study, and I'm not recalling the name of the study at this point. I think it was named after a judge. The Gleaves study of how many sessions ago?
Well, Madam Chair, Wally Carson, goes clear back to Carl Byers. It's a 20-year project that has been named by the chairs, Byers, Tone, Gleaves, and now it's the Willis Committee. Same idea.
Let's bring that information forward, particularly for our new committee members, as Senator Winters is suggesting. I think that would be helpful. Senator Devlin.
I just wanted to point out, because it is an item of discussion, that, and I'm sure that there are probably other counties that have experienced it, it isn't only just population and workload, it's the ability to provide facilities. One of my three metropolitan counties, I'm actually in all three, has had a long history of not being able to pass bond measures to build facilities, so they have considerably less actual elected circuit court judges than their population and workload would actually indicate that they would need, and they depend on actually having some pro tem judges to be able to meet part of that need in very creative ways. But there are other reasons why some counties don't have the number of judges that you would normally think that they would have.
Thank you. Mr. Bray. Excuse me.
Judge,
I didn't know where they were.
Just very briefly, Madam Chair, the bill, because it is statutorily created, mm-hmm. the new judgeships, the bill is being heard is tentatively scheduled for next Wednesday, the 23rd, in Judiciary. And we did, a couple of weeks ago, receive the latest study report, and I have a copy with me, and I didn't know if you get into it before Phase 2, but I'd be happy to make them available now. And we also do have one page, and we're updating it, that shows the history of what's been recommended and what's been approved over the last several biennium in the way of new judgeships.
What page is that?
It's a page that's not in your current book that I had for reference, and we'll bring it tomorrow.
Madam Chair, since the bill will be heard, is in the process of being heard, I think it might be well if we did have a copy of that material, just in case some members of this body here would like to assist, even though it's in a substance committee. I think I'm always mindful that I'm here in Marion County, and I believe that we get more than our share of workload, because we tend to have, all of the, ultimately the measures and everything comes here. So that's another part of the dimensions of the need when we talk about the judicial branch. So I, for one, would like to have the information just in case I want to make certain that my county is included.
Very good. Thank you. And Judge, had you completed your comments?
Madam Chair, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Bray, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Doug Bray, and I'm the trial court administrator for the Circuit Court of the State of Oregon from Multnomah County. The Chief Justice opened with a fortune cookie slip about selling new ideas. I want to build on something he said about the vision that, certainly under his leadership, that we have adopted in the Oregon Judicial Department, and which guides us, and which has significantly changed the way courts do business in our communities and our state. The Chief Justice told you we have a vision. The vision is based on the rule of law. What that means for us, first of all, is that we support the rule of law. We support access to justice, and we support appropriate dispute resolution. What that translates to is that we have changed from an institution that has judges sitting in courtrooms waiting for cases to be brought to them to be tried, to an institution where our goal is to resolve every dispute as early as possible, at the lowest cost possible to both the state and the litigants, and as quickly as possible. So that has had a profound impact on the kinds of work we do and the kinds of programs we support. As a trial court administrator, we work very hard to support with our community partners building programs that are going to solve problems in our community. And that's not just in the criminal justice area, that's in family law, that's in juvenile law. It's also in dealing with the needs of the business community to have expeditious court services available for the enforcement of business obligations and the rights of parties to contracts and business agreements. That process of investing in building problem-solving courts has changed very much how we do business. And so we're a very different court system now than we were even 10 years ago. And I think that change has been really pervasive throughout the state under Chief Justice Carson's leadership. I have 26 counterparts, and we are all pretty much on the same page about what our obligations are. We do face some challenges. I mean, we always face budgetary challenges. We face challenges in terms of technology, not having enough technology to reach the public in ways we would like to reach them, not having electronic systems to speed the work along. But we are working on those, and we work on them every biennium with this body. And we bring to you our wish list, and we do the best we can with the resources you grant us. Our experience in the last biennium, 01-03, at the end of the biennium, with the budget reductions was significant. Work was delayed. There was degradation of public service. Programs were dismantled and staff were depleted. When those things happen, it's very difficult to maintain the courts as problem-solving players in our community. And it's very difficult also for our community partners to continue to be engaged with us as they lose resources. So, as with every other agency, we're here telling you we need the resources that we've asked for to conduct our programs and to carry out our mission as it's been defined in our vision. We would like you to do the best you can with that request. The work of the courts is constantly growing. It's a growth industry, and we continually are able to manage that growth through investments in technology, through changing the way we do business, and I think that we, not any individual, but collectively have built for you a court system of which you can be proud. So that's it.
Comments? Questions? Thank you both very much. We really appreciate you being here today, and we look forward to continuing partnership and other conversations down the road.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Thank you. Ms. Quick, looking at the time remaining and also looking at what is left on our agenda, recognizing that we can do some shifts into tomorrow if we need to do that, where would you like to go next?
Chair Gordley, I'd like to just draw attention to a couple of more facts regarding the trial court program summary and then touch on mandated. We could give you a very brief overview of administration that would set the stage for tomorrow. Well, I'll watch the time here.
Very good.
Any questions? With regard to the trial courts, they are 70% of our overall general funded budget. They are, as noted, in the circuit courts are located in all 36 counties. Where they sit, the counties they sit in, how many judges are designated in the statutes. And what our balance always is there's a minimum to having a court just open for business in any location. So when we have reductions or consolidations, it's very difficult to reduce, and we usually exempt a number of the very smallest courts from the most draconian of the cuts just to keep them open at the same level that other courts are statewide. We also do try to balance out statewide the resource needs in staffing as well as dollars. So when we're in cuts, we all try to adjust in the same manner with a statewide plan. One of the efficiencies that you do get with statewide systems is you get a consistency of justice. And consistency doesn't necessarily mean uniformity, because there's a lot of latitude within the governing policies and rules and statutes to respond to the local community. And we feel it's very important to keep that balance there for the circuit courts to be able to respond to the dynamics of their community in delivering the services. But behind that, we do provide the statewide consistency where we must, as a state entity, to comply with laws or to use central resources to provide information, research forms, assistance to all the counties that wouldn't ordinarily be able to do that. And as when we get into administration a little more, you'll see that we're the central personnel system for the statewide system. We're unlike the ESDs, where everyone has their own separate set of governance. We really are, under the Chief Justice, a centrally managed system to the degree of infrastructure, IT services, personnel, and budget and fiscal. But locally, in delivery of services, we try to allow a lot of customized work. The other thing that will that affects the trial court program area, which I know Senator Devlin has had some interest in the past, has been the pro tem services, and all our judges are, by Chief Justice order, allowed to sit anywhere in the state to help out with backlogs or conflicts of cases, as well as we have a whole, we have about 22 senior judges in any given year that are regularly providing free pro tem service in exchange for being on the Plan B retirement benefit. And we use those services to the maximum every year in trying to cover our judgeship needs.
Senator Winters.
Senator, you may want to explain your senior judges a little more. I'm not certain that everyone understands that they are retired and their services that they're giving is you're not paying for that service. I know one of the retired judges from my community is traveling around the state and is a pro tem. So for the new members, it might be very helpful if they knew more about that.
Senator Gordley and Senator Winters, briefly, there is a what we call a senior judge program that complements our regular sitting judges, and the additional judicial services in the senior judge ranks come from either judges who are what we call completely retired and are able to, we pay for their service going to district. We also have the majority of our senior judges are what we call the Plan B judges, where in exchange for a slightly higher accrual rate in their retirement benefit, they provide 5 years, 35 days a year of free judicial services for the 5 years after they leave. And that gives us over about 2,000 days of service every biennium of what I call the free assistance, and quite valuable to us. We also use attorneys who've been approved by the Supreme Court, and there's a whole program with that, and they also can supplement our judicial services, but they also are paid.
Madam Chair, thanks Senator Winters for that. I have a friend in Sun River who participates in that program, and I used to play a lot of golf. He plays a lot of golf, and I used to before I became a politician, but he now classmate of Chief Justice Carson. Thank you.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you. Do we not also have the pro tem? Is that the lawyers that you talk about, pro tem judges?
Senator Gordley, Representative Hannon, yes, they're all, a pro tem is a temporary designation authority, so we do have pro tem judges who are lawyers as well as retired judges.
Follow up to that. What, in Douglas County, it seems as though we have a permanent pro tem. I mean, it's like there's plenty of work there, so that particular judge is always working.
Senator Gordley, Representative Hannon, you're probably referring to the referee position that's been in Douglas County, that he also sits pro tem, has pro tem authority.
Mm-hmm.
Several biennium ago, the legislature was unable to fund full judgeships, and they provided some referee positions that went at that time to courts of highest need. And a lot of those positions are what we call referees. They're authority isn't final, though some of them have received approval from the Supreme Court to be pro tem judges, and in that case they can take the same actions as sitting judge, though that is supposed to be renewed on every 3-year basis and sometimes looks more permanent than temporary.
I could follow up one more time.
Certainly.
So will we get to the budget detail that delineates those judges from the actual circuit court judge? I mean, will we know how much of the, what percentage of the work they do versus the seated?
Senator Gordley, Representative Hannon, we do have that information, and we do have the number of referees in the system and what case types they cover.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with your
please
permission.
Come forward.
I can't blame Representative Hannah, members of the committee. It's an oxymoron. We have permanent pro tems. And we have had, because we don't have enough judges around the state, we think. And so we do have Newport, Roseburg, Multnomah County, Marion County, others, that when we didn't get judges, just as Ms. Click said, we got authority to have a referee, and then the Supreme Court can grant the pro tem. We have referees that can only deal in certain limited areas, in juvenile court particularly. And if you go before a referee, you have the authority to appeal, to take your case back to a circuit court judge, a regular circuit court judge. If the Supreme Court, by the Constitution, it was changed in, I forgot, 65 or so, the Supreme Court has authority to grant pro tem approval, circuit judge approval, and so magically they become a circuit judge. We do that fairly uniformly. Even if you are in the juvenile court, we give you pro tem so that you can fill in if you have to go next door and do some other project where you have to be a circuit judge to do it. I don't blame you for the confusion, because it's confusing to all of us, but we have pro tems that have been with us, well, not as long as I have, but been with us for a long time. For some time, yeah. Okay. I wish it were otherwise, and we may be litigated. Some states have litigated that issue, but right now it's out of necessity, and so we don't have a judicial position, and you're the ones that determine judicial positions, and we don't have that, and we don't have funding for it. And there was a period of time in about 1997, 99, where it seemed that this body was directed toward not ever having another elected judge, but always going toward appointed judges that were pro tems, because it was cheaper. And fortunately, we've matured from that position, and we're not in that direction, I hope. That's a good question. Thank you.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Ms. Click, I have a question for you. Looking at the trial court summary section of our agenda, I know that we passed over Nancy Miller purposely at one point. Would this be a good time to bring her on to wrap up the trial court summary section of the agenda before moving into any of the other conversations?
Yes, I think I will save Nancy for your lightness tomorrow. she was going to come up and touch on some of the trial court in with the administration major initiatives. And Nancy, do you want to do it today, or would you like to work it into performance measures tomorrow?
I'll just do it quickly.
Okay.
Thank you,
Chair. Senator
Devlin? Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe she'll do it quickly today, but I'm going to get into more tomorrow. I had some more questions, actually, about the Oregon Judicial Information Network.
Oh, yes.
And what the future of that is. And
we'll have more time.
Okay.
Please.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, my name is Nancy Miller. I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Program Operations, and I'll be speaking to you from pages 25 to 34 of your notebook. I've been asked to just chat with you about some of our major program initiatives. My division works very closely with the trial courts in supporting the programs that I describe as actually being on-the-ground work at the trial court level. I'll talk very briefly about some of these and then be happy to answer any questions tomorrow or whenever you've got some time for that. I'll start with the appropriate dispute resolution services. As a result of the abolition of the Dispute Resolution Commission last session, the Judicial Department is now charged with rulemaking authority over court-connected mediators. We've been working on that project for the last 2 years. We are just about to send our suggested rules to the Uniform Trial Court Rules Committee for adoption, so that's pretty exciting. The Juvenile Court Improvement Project that Judge Kosh mentioned briefly is a federal grant that the department receives, wrapped up in what we call Creating Juvenile Court Champions. The Chief Justice has been a strong supporter of that project, and I could spend easily 2 hours telling you all the exciting things that have happened in juvenile court as a result of the very small sum of money that we get from the federal government, but I'll spare you all the details. The next one I'd like to talk to you about very briefly is the Citizen Review Board program. The Citizen Review Board program has about 400 volunteers in it that conduct reviews of child abuse and neglect and delinquency cases if children or youth offenders are placed outside of their homes into the foster care system. Those reviews are mandated by both federal and state law. So the reviews are required, quite honestly, whether you have a CRB or not. The question is how you want those reviews to be done. And in this state, the legislature in its ultimate wisdom decided that those reviews would be done by the citizenry. It's an amazing program. I have been with the CRB program since 1986. It is my heart in the Judicial Department, and I will not run on it. But you can see very briefly, the volunteers in the CRB donated over 80,000 hours to this state in performing the very important work that they do. Court Interpreter Services is another
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnow.
Thank you, ma'am. Mrs. Miller, how does that interrelate to CASA? And it looks like there's some overlap or duplication. Is that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, the easiest way to describe that is that is that the Citizen Review Board program sits in the role of the judge. The CASA sits in the role, if you will, of a party.
We said citizen advocate support, court-appointed
special advocate.
Special advocate, Senator Winters.
I don't know where
the court-appointed special advocates are parties to the case. They advocate for the individual child. The Citizen Review Board is a review body that looks more like a court. So the roles are very, very different. A CASA, if you want to compare that role, is more like the role of a lawyer or a caseworker. We are more like the role of a judge. That's the easy explanation.
Madam Chair, it might be just really helpful for a high-level explanation of why we went to those two organizations some years ago.
Madam Chair, Senator Winters, the Citizen Review Board was created out of a grassroots movement that really revolved around concerns that children are being lost in the child welfare system, that courts did not have adequate time or resources. He's paying money. That courts did not have adequate time or resources to devote to review these cases, and so bring the public in to spend adequate time and to bring that third-party look at cases was the way the legislature decided to go. Same thing with CASA, which is housed in the Commission for Children and Families, so somebody else is hearing that budget. But again, those citizen advocates, that program was created at the same time as the CRB, kind of as an offload to the job of the caseworker, the job of the lawyer to advocate for the individual child.
Representative Hanna.
This is just a quick question. How many volunteers do you have?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, almost 400.
1,000 hours.
And 80,000 hours? 400 volunteers?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes. They spend approximately each one, they're about usually 5 volunteers on an individual board. They spend 8 hours preparing for reviews, approximately 8 hours a month doing reviews, 8 hours a year in training, 16 hours in orientation training. So when you add it all up, for the 400 volunteers, it comes out to almost 80,000 hours. They're a good deal.
I guess.
I do note that there are 3 counties without a Citizens Review Board. What happens with those 3 counties?
Madam Chair, those cases are reviewed by the normally either in the county court or internally by DHS. Our enabling legislation said counties with populations of 5,000 or more. We actually pick up some of the Sherman and Wheeler cases if they're managed by the Morrow branch of DHS. But the enabling legislation says 5,000 or less.
You have about 4 minutes left just to give you a time check, and I really don't want to rush you through our presentation.
So please end at a natural point, and we will pick up where we leave off tomorrow.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I am pulling the stick back. So if you want to push the stick back down tomorrow, we can do that. Court Interpreter Services is another major component of the division that I direct. A very exciting and relatively new program to the OJD, Oregon Judicial Department. I almost had to pay. We have staff interpreters in a number of our courts. In other courts, we are still contracting with certified interpreters, but the administrative arm of the Interpreter Services Division delivers the kind of services that you see there on your handout. We are very involved in making sure that we are negotiating rates and terms with the certifieds, that we are doing regular audits of the interpreter billings. We're involved in testing and quality control. And I just started supervising the interpreter program about a year and a half ago, and a more committed group of people you would be hard-pressed to meet. They are performing excellent services out in the trial courts.
I would think that it's also accurate to say here that the court interpreter services, that whole initiative comes out of the Chief Justice leadership in the access to justice arena, and that we are where we are today as a result of a quality of leadership that he and others, most certainly Ms. Click and yourself and others who are unnamed today, have been providing. And it is something that we can be proud of. But at the same time, we do need to understand what are the limitations and challenges within the current operation of Court Interpretive Services. And I'd like to leave you with that thought as we close as part of our hearing today. And let's pick this up again tomorrow. Representative Hansen. And
real quick question to start with tomorrow. In your performance measures on certified interpreters, it says spoken language. Does that also apply to American Sign Language?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we do have now two staff sign language interpreters, so we are tracking sign language as well. So, Madam Chair, I will close for today. There are just a couple of quick things we could talk about tomorrow, but I want to save at least 1 minute if anybody had a burning question.
Senator Winters.
I don't have a question. I just would like to recognize my judge, Pamela Abernathy, who's in the back.
Wonderful. We'll be back tomorrow.
We'll be back tomorrow to talk about all the wonderful things that we're doing in Marion County in family court, and we're probably I have to say this because I have to put it on record. This state could not exist with all the volunteer hours and all the work that's done among individuals that are, I think, are unsung heroes and heroines in this state when we look at the programs that are there. And I think when we're talking budgetary issues, that often this piece of what's going on in our local communities that are taking place and trying to put children and families and things together, we don't see or hear about. And I have to say a big thank you to my judges in my community, because it was because of them talking to me back in 98 when I ran, and in 99 that made the passion for me to get involved in this whole methamphetamine issue and to get involved in talking about we can do things better in our community. So I have to say that thank you, and because they are involved in more than rendering decisions and making opinions. They're actively in our communities. They're actively working, trying to resolve problems locally. Those of you who are involved in relief nursery kind of activities, I think you will find that your judges and members of your community are also actively involved in those activities, and I just need to put that on record.
And Madam Chair, if I can make just one closing comment to follow up on what you said, the only thing that I can talk longer about than the Citizen Review Board is the leadership of the Chief Justice and what he the the passion that he has inspired in the staff and the judges in the Judicial Department is amazing. He's my hero, and he knows it.
Well, we share the hero. And members, we are adjourned, and we will begin on time tomorrow. Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you.